podcast just before, or at least a few days before, Halloween. I hope you really enjoy it. We've got a slightly different format in that there'll be three shorter, darker, scarier tales without actually any food in them. And then I'll be looking at three foods which are particularly seasonal for this time of year and have quite a big folkloric impact. The first tale is Crooker from the dark and scary Derbyshire countryside, as collected in Forgotten Folk Tales of the English Counties by Ruth Tong. The second tale is, I think, is the darkest of the three and was collected by Catherine Briggs from Scotland. It's called The Flight of the Birds. Our third tale is, well, still scary, but perhaps slightly more light-hearted, although it is a little gruesome, and that's The Elder Tree Witch, again from Forgotten Folk Tales of the English Counties, collected by Ruth Tong. Are you in a suitably spooky setting? Or are you going to let the dark tales take you there by themselves? If you're sitting comfortably, or at least listening comfortably, I'll begin. Crooker, a Derbyshire folk tale. A traveller, having received news that his mother was desperately ill from a stranger on horseback, was on his way to Cromford late in the evening when an old woman came from the hillside and met him. "Where are you going so late?" she asked. "The sun has gone down, and it will soon be dark. This is no road to travel at night." He was silent, and then she said, "I see you are wise enough not to speak and put yourself in danger, but I doubt if you'll be safe from Crooker without the right kind of help." He looked at her in the low light and saw she was holding out a posy to him. He hesitated. It looked as though she was dressed in green linen, but when he saw the posy was St. John's wort. The old woman nodded. "I wish you well," she said. "You once freed a bird from a fowler's net. I knew that bird. Take this posy, and when you travel the Cromford Road, show it to Crooker." "Who is Crooker?" said the traveller, but the old woman was gone. He was all alone, with a posy in his hand. That was an honest warning, he thought, but I must go on to Cromford for all that. And he went on his way. Another old woman was waiting for him on the lane side, and though it was getting dark, he could see that she was dressed in green linen also, and held out a posy of primroses. "No one travels the Cromford Road at night," she said. "I must," he said, for he knew by the posy that she wished him well. "My mother is ill, and she needs me." "Then show these to Crooker," said she, and he took the second posy. "You freed a rabbit from a snare. I knew that rabbit, and you need the right kind of help." "Who is Crooker?" asked the traveller, but she too was gone, and he was all alone. "It will be dark before moonrise," said the traveller. "I doubt I'll need my two posies on the road. That was some more honest help, but I'd feel safer with three. I must hurry up." And he went on into the dusk. At the corner of the lane, he met a third woman in green, holding a posy this time of daisies. "It's a dark and dangerous time to travel the Cromford Road," she said. "You can really do with the right kind of help. Take the posy and show it to Crooker." "Who is Crooker?" asked the traveller, who was desperate to know by now. She did not answer, however, but said, "You freed a vixen and her cub from a trap." "I knew that cub and that vixen. So here's a second bit of advice. Keep as far from the Derwent River as you can, and the Cromford Road runs beside it. You must be on Cromford Bridge before the moon rises." And then she too went away. Well, suddenly, and he just couldn't see her anymore, and again he was all alone, except for his three flower posies. "I'm going to need these," he thought. "Honest help never comes amiss. I'm so tired. I doubt if I reach the shrine on Cromford Bridge before moonrise. I'll be glad if it's light, for they say the Derwent runs fast and deep, and I'd not like to miss my footing and fall in." But when at last he came to Cromford Road, the moon was high overhead and very bright. The river swirled by just below, and there were great trees on the bank above the road that cast strange, muddling shadows that breathed in the breeze. "I don't like the look of those moving branches," said the traveller. "There's one tree all by itself that frightens me. Its shadows look like skinny, clutching hands. I'm close to the Cromford Bridge now, I'll run past it. And for all his weariness, he did. But then the river began to ripple loudly, and the sounds it made sounded as if it was crying, "Hungry." And on the moonlit road before him, he saw the chasing shadow of long, crooked hands like branches. "Crooker!" gasped the traveller, and without looking back, he held the posy of daisies over his left shoulder onto the road. The shadow disappeared. The river cried, "Give!" and there was a splash. The terrified traveller began hobbling run for the safety of the bridge and its shrine, but once more the chasing shadow of Crooker came onto the road in front of him, and he hurled the posy of primroses over his left shoulder. Crooker stopped. The Derwent River cried, "Give!" and there was a second splash. Fear lent wings to the traveller's weary feet. He was almost at the bridge itself, when once more the clutching shadow lay across his way. With his last strength, he turned right around and flung the posy of St. John's Wort straight at the wicked tree. It cried out terribly as the traveller gave a despairing leap onto Cromford Bridge and fell in a swoon at the foot of the shrine. The Derwent River roared and moaned, and the good people of Cromford looked at each other white-faced. "Derwent and Crooker," they whispered, "we must go at sunrise and take the priest. There'll be another debt for the churchyard." Do you remember the old beggar woman we found with a broken neck, drowned in the Derwent one night? She was, he roared then. But when they came to the Cromford Bridge in bright sunlight, there was a pale, footsore traveller saying his prayers at the shrine. He got up stiffly and hobbled on his way to the village, while the Derwent River ran shallow and sunny below the bank where the great barren ash tree stood. As he reached his mother's house, she came rushing out. The traveller was really surprised. He had only braved the Cromford Road because of his mother's illness. "But I've never been ill," she said. "I've never had a day's illness in my life." And now for our second tale, The Flight of the Birds. There was once a farmer living in a wild part of the country, where strangers seldom came. His wife was very beautiful, dark of hair and pale of skin. She was a good wife to him. Her husband loved her so fondly and so jealously that he could hardly bear another man to set eyes on her. He didn't really even like her going to the market. But so far as these things went, they were happy. That changed on the night of the great storm. Storm and wind forced a small boat to seek shelter in the little bay near the farm, and a stranger came knocking at the door to ask for food and lodging. He was a fine-looking man, and as he sat warming himself by the fire and glancing at the wife as she moved around the room, it came into the farmer's head that anyone who saw them would say they would make a wonderful couple, and he himself looked nothing next to them. "It doesn't take much to spark a jealous heart." And as he was thinking so, it chanced that the stranger yawned, and from the table where she was laying supper, his wife yawned too. "Ah," thought the husband, "there's but one thought between them. Likely they're lovers from long ago, and he came here with no purpose but to be with her." No sooner did the thought pass through his head than he took it as the absolute truth, and all through supper he sat glowering there without a word to throw at the dog. If he had met on the road of the market, he would have fought the stranger and tried to kill him, but he was a guest, and his life was sacred. The stranger, unsettled by the horrible atmosphere, went into the bedroom that had been prepared for him and fell asleep. And then the husband took a rope down from the rafters, took his wife by the wrist. "Come," he said, and led her out into the stormy night. "What's the matter? What do you want from me?" "I want to keep you an honest and faithful wife, and I see no way for it but to hang you. That'll be your old love, no doubt." "I declare to God, I have never seen him until this day." Then the thought went quickly between you. Why did you yawn when he yawned? And for all his wife could say and beg, she could not shake his belief, nor soften his heart. He put the rope around her neck and led her towards the nearest tree. The wind was dropping, but it still blew hard, and they struggled against it towards a ragged wood that stood in a sheltered valley not far from the farm. As they went, a flock of small birds passed them, fluttering against the wind. The moon shone out fitfully as they reached the first tree, and the farmer threw up his rope over the lowest branch. He crossed it, but it wouldn't stick there, because the flight of birds landed on the branch and slid down over their beating wings. He tried again, but with no better success. "We'll leave that tree to the birds," he said, "and go to the next." They moved on, but the flight of birds went with them, and when the farmer threw up the rope, it slid down once more. And then his wife spoke for the first time since they'd set out. "The birdies are going from tree to tree," she said. "They know I'm innocent." The farmer was obstinate. "We'll try it again," he said, and he went on, and the birds went with them. Then again, his rope slipped down, and his wife said, "The birds know that I'm innocent. That's why they're following us." But he was obstinate still, and tried one tree after another, after another, after another, all through the wood, and still the birds went before them. "At last," he said, this wood is overfull of birds. "But I remember an old fir tree that stands in the lane on the hillside, a little way off. And the wind blows so fast through it that birds won't even land on the branches. We're going there." So they set off on the long tramp, his wife sobbing quietly. And the birds left the wood and soared high up into the air, and for a while they did not see them. They went on and on, struggling against the wind, until they reached one lonely pine on its hilltop in the grey light before dawn. "There are no birds here to save you," said the farmer, and flung the rope up to the nearest branch high above them. But as he threw, there was a grand whir of wings, and the birds leapt down from the sky again, and the rope fell to the ground. As the first rays of sun fell on the farmer's wife, she said again, "The birds know I'm innocent, please, please." At the sight and the sound, the farmer's heart was softened, and he burst into tears. He knew that his wife was true to him, and he knew that if he had murdered her in his jealous anger, the birds would have followed him night and day, and he would have known no rest. He took the rope from his wife's neck, and they returned to the farmhouse. No one knows if she stayed with him.
And now, for our third tale, as everyone knows, the best things come in threes. There's a farm down in Somerset. Not on the best bit of land, but the farmer who lives there has made the best of it. His cows make the best milk. They are perfect for butter, perfect for cheese, and perfect just to drink. There's no big trees on the farm, but there's good hedges. But there's no elder trees, definitely no elder trees. No one likes elder thereabouts. There was a tale that great-great-granddads used to tell, that they'd heard from their great-granddads, about a man who went to chop down an elder tree and it bled and chased him. And he might have thought about the fact that witches can turn into elders if they wish, but he didn't, and he got a terrible chasing until he crossed running water. Well, whether a farmer believed the tale or not, there came a time when his cows were being milked without his knowledge. He wasn't a rich man, and he couldn't afford the loss, so he got up by starlight and went out to make sure his cows were safe. And when he got up to the field, the cows did seem fine, but there was a shadow of a tree by the hedge. There shouldn't have been a tree there, so in a cold sweat he drove the cows to the little home pasture, but a chain wasn't on the gate, and he couldn't fasten it with iron, so he just put a big stone against it and then went to bed. Come the next morning, he told his womenfolk what he'd seen, and his wife said, "You great big fool, didn't you draw a cross in the mud by the gate?" No, he hadn't. And his daughter, she got up and peeked out the window and turned as pale as curd cheese and ran around shutting all the windows and shutting all the shutters inside them safely, saying, the tree, it's on the pasture now, right among the cows." "Oh, Lord save us," said his wife. "What tree is it?" "It's an elder," said the girl, shivering and shaking. "An old granny." She was sitting by the fire and simply leaned over and took the big iron shovel and pushed it in amongst the red-hot embers and raked in a big faggot of ash to make a blaze. "Elder," said the farmer, and he was all a shiver too, but he was a brave man and his cows really were precious to him. "Wife," he said, because that's how people used to talk in those days to their wives, "go and get the silver button that came off my Sunday coat." Well, she was a bit annoyed because she'd already sewed it on again, but she went and she sniffed it off and brought it to him. And by that time he loaded his gun with it, the daughter had swung the crossbar down across the back door, and Granny, she'd got the iron shovel nice and hot. His wife opened the front door a crack and he took a look. There, right in the middle of the field, right amongst the middle of his cows, was the tree. And because of the cows, he couldn't take a long shot. He was frightened of hitting them and hurting them. "I'm going to have to get right up against it," he said. "Hold the door open and let me out and in again if I have to run for it." And his wife lifted the bar and he went out trembling all over. He was desperate to save his cows. The elder tree really was right in amongst them with its branches. And he had to get too close for comfort, really, to take aim. But for the life of him, he couldn't hold the gun steady. And sadly, the silver button missed her. Well, she let out a yell, and so did he. And she leapt after him like a stag. And he leapt too. And she came rushing after him, and he went rushing for the open door. He was a sturdy farmer, but he made pace that day. And his wife slammed the door so quick behind him that she caught his coattails in it. And for all that, she dropped the iron bar safe into its socket. And there they were, safe inside. But they could hear her branches a scratching and a rattling outside and shrieking like a high wind. The wife and daughter shrieked too, and the farmer shouted like a bull calf trying to get his coattails free and be out to his cows again. He had courage, you see, but he didn't have the right knowledge, or at least not enough of it. They could hear her rushing around the house, tap, tap, tapping on the shutters, tap, tap, tapping on the shutters. Then he'd hear her on the roof, scratching and scratching and shrieking and scratching all over the roof. She couldn't get down the chimney because Granny had put that faggot of ash, which was burning away, keeping the house safe. But the more I thought about it, she couldn't get in, but they couldn't get out. And what was going to happen to the cows and the pig and the pony and the dog with his puppies in the stable in the garden? Well, Granny got up from the hearth side with a great shovel of burning coals and turned to her granddaughter. "Open that back door now, wide," she said. And she did, and she ran back to her mother. But Granny, she just stood there. And when the elder tree came straight at her, leaping and shrieking, she just up and threw all the red hot coals at her and came in and shut the back door. They could see blue flames flicker and hear the tree crackling, and then whoosh, as the whole thing caught fire. After a bit, Granny took the ash cattle fork and went, and out there, there was no longer an elder tree, just a great heap of ashes, cold already. And the women all made the cross on the ashes with the ash wood fork. And then they ran. And they opened the shutters and the front door again, and the farmer was able to free his coattails and go out to his cows. Then all the neighbours came, and they all rejoiced. And they said, "That'll be the end of Madam Widdicombe and her coach and that gold pig who pulls it." But one neighbour said, no, it isn't, that's not right, she's still around. Anyway, more of a wise woman than a witch. She's good for warts, that sort of thing. The man from Coombe Witch said, "No, and it isn't that old black witch, oversteered." And then they couldn't work it out. But someone realised, and had been told, that Raggy Liddy, over at Doddington, had fallen in her fire and died. So, that was who it was. And that is the end of our tales. And I hope they pleased you, for they had no other purpose. What did you think of our dark tales? Did you enjoy the tree connection? I know The Flight of the Birds isn't a traditional scary story,
but it's so dark and it brings out the scariness of the stormy winter nighttime forest and the fear of being all alone with a persecutor in a lonely place. The really terrifying element of the story for me is being at the mercy of someone who should love you, but thinks that love means they own your life, and by extension of that ownership, can simply choose to take your life away. The birds show that there can still be some hope, and even small, helpless beings can band together to protect another vulnerable life. The fact that dawn breaking is enough to stop the terror is one thing this shares with more traditional scary stories. Light brings salvation from the terrifying things that happen in the dark. I've read two versions of this tale, one collected by Catherine Briggs and one told by Lisha Schneidau, and though my version of the tale is closer to the collected version, I have adopted Lisa's ending. I felt the uncertainty was a fitting ending for such a frightening tale. Crooker is another dark tale of the English countryside, another example of how the quiet, gentle, natural beauty of pastoral surroundings can quickly become a different, more dangerous world as soon as the sun goes down. There are so many folklore references in this tale, I generally don't have room to mention them all, so I'm going to stick to three. I'm nothing if not traditional when it comes to numbers. I'll mention the ash tree momentarily, but I also wanted to quickly reference the dress of the women who helped the traveller and the relevance of the plants and their posies. The reticence of the traveller to speak with the first old woman comes from his belief that she could be dangerous, and to stay silent is a form of protection. He thought she was potentially dangerous because she was a fairy, and he identified that from her green dress. The sonnet John's wort in the posy is a flower of protection, and the primrose is a sign of spring, and the daisy is a sign of health. Those are the relevance of the posies at any rate. The elder tree witch is another interesting one, and although it involves some pretty dark and gruesome undertones, it at least has a little levity. It also brings home to us how much damage could be done to a farm from theft and low milk yields. In a rural economy, anyone who damaged livestock was a massive threat to the farm's income, and thus to the lives of the farmer and his family. There are some interesting folklore themes in this story, especially around the elder tree, and again the ash tree, so it's probably time to address those now. Let's look at the elder tree first. It very much has a dual nature, considered both a poor man's medicine chest for the amount of folk remedies that can be derived from its fruit, flowers and bark, a witch deterrent as well as a tree that could shelter a witch. It's also supposedly offered protection from lightning because it was considered one of the woods that made up the cross at the crucifixion. It was believed that if you cut an elder tree, it would bleed. It was also not to be used for firewood, usually because it was considered to invite the devil into your house. Although possibly it was because elder spits and screams as it burns due to the sap in the wood. It was also believed in Somerset that elder could not be destroyed properly unless it was burned. There are some experts who believe the elder was essentially given bad press in order to discourage its use because many of its uses came from its pagan roots, although there are some other explanations too. Ash is another interesting tree, although it is unusual to see it as an incarnation of evil. It's usually thought to offer protection from evil and witchcraft, especially in the form of an ash faggot for burning, as in the Elder Witch tale, or in tools used for caring for farm animals. It's thought to be a lightning tree, as it was the tree that Odin hanged himself in his pursuit for wisdom. It was linked to safe childbirth and the promotion of childhood health. It was considered to be the best wood for getting rid of snakes and for healing snake bites. Children could also be passed through the trunk of an ash to clear up whooping cough or other childhood infirmities. They were only really considered ill-omened trees when they were a barren tree, as in the case of Crooker. I wish I could spend longer examining the folklore in these stories. It's absolutely fascinating about what these tales have to tell us. However, as I promised, you have some food folklore about Halloween, so I sadly don't have the time. Let's look at our first traditional seasonal food instead. Colcannon, an Irish recipe traditionally eaten on the 31st of October. It's a mixture of kale or cabbage and smashed potato with butter and milk. Don't hold back on the butter. Some people add scallions and or leeks. The first known written mention of it was from a diary in 1735 by a Welsh traveller to Dublin. It became popular in the UK too. See recipes from Margaret Dodd's Cook and Housewife's Manual in 1826 and Eliza Acton's Modern Cookery in 1857. As well as the appropriate Irish way to cook potatoes for the best results.
That's history, you say. Where's the folklore? Well, did you know you could tell fortunes with cockhammon? At Halloween, the dish contains a ring and a thimble. If you get the ring, then marriage to the person of your dreams within the year. If you get the thimble, then no wedding for you, at least not in the next 12 months. You could also put the first and last bite of the cockhammon in a stocking and hang it on the door. The next man through the door would be your husband. And if you have a hawthorn tree handy, you can also leave a bowl as an offering to the fairies. Our next seasonal ingredient is nuts. Walnuts, specifically. I'm not going to give you a long history, but it's safe to say they've been around for ages. They're in season between July and November and have some interesting folklore, particularly around this season. This concerns Nutcrack Night, which is celebrated in Scotland and Northern England on the 31st of October. A pair of nuts are named for each member of a couple and then placed on a fire. The couple then say the rhyme, "If you hate me, spit and fly. If you love me, burn away." If they burn to ashes, the couple will have a long and happy life together. But if the nuts spit and roll apart, they'll separate soon. These would have been any nuts available, really, but walnuts are good for rolling. They were eaten regularly, but within predictable crops were more likely to have been harvested green and pickled and used for cordial waters to avoid wastage. They were also stored for future use, as you can see from these recipes from the English Art of Cookery from 1788 and The Complete Housewife from 1773. However, I thought these recipes for walnut tablet and date and walnut loaf were more suitable for modern celebrations from the Glasgow Cookery Book, first printed in 1910. You can relax, eat, pop some nuts on the fire. Our final seasonal food is soul cakes. These cakes were originally baked for beggars who had promised to pray for those souls in purgatory on All Souls Day, the 2nd of November. This was largely suffocated as a custom in England when the church split from the Catholic Church in Rome. The custom did continue, if only in the form of remembrance for the dead rather than actual praying for souls, in those areas further from authorities than London, than, say, Wales, Midlands and the North. Although it morphed then into groups of men who performed mumming plays, and then even further into groups of children who went house to house singing rhymes to get soul cakes, or, in the case of some areas, fresh fruit. This was known as souling. There was an excellent article in Folklore from 1914 by Charlotte Byrne, who talks about these customs in the West Counties of the Midlands. The article also includes tales of clementing and cattening, with similar rituals celebrating St Clement and St Catherine today's later in the month. The article also connects the celebrations with the old financial practices of communities where accounts were settled at the end of October. I don't have my own recipe for soul cakes, but perhaps you can adjust this one from Country Dishes, edited by Barbara Hargreaves, from the introduction, Traditional Farmhouse Recipes from the Counties of Great Britain, compiled by Susan Bedell, from a host of recipes collected from farmers' wives. Also contributions from earlier publications, County Federation of Women's Institutes and Farmers' Weeklies. Recipes handed down to them and which they have proven, thanks to all those who have preserved them. These recipes were first published in 1962, with local and regional recipes handed down in families and dated from the 1800s. Here's the recipe for souling cake. Take 3/4 of a pound of flour, 1/2 teaspoonful of cinnamon, 1/2 teaspoonful of mixed spice, pinch of fresh nutmeg, 6 ounces of sugar, 6 ounces of butter, 1 egg, 1.5 teaspoonful of vinegar. Mix the dry ingredients, rub in the fat, drop in an egg and vinegar and knead until soft. Roll out 1/4 inch thick, cut into rounds with a big cutter and bake in a moderate oven for 15 or 20 minutes until slightly coloured. You may not go out souling, but you will at least have a lovely snack just to keep you warm, you know, around that fire where you've put those walnuts. I hope you've really enjoyed today's episode. I've enjoyed making it, even though some of those dark stories were, well, you know, very dark. I also enjoyed researching the food too, so I hope you've enjoyed that bit. And I think probably that's the end for us for today. As always, if you are, you know, in the mood for doing a review or perhaps giving, you know, a 5-star rating, you could pop along to Apple Podcasts and do that. It does help other people find the show. Or if you're just enjoying listening, I'd really love to have you back again next time. Well, we'll be talking about some more seasonal things, but, you know, perhaps not quite so scary, at least hopefully not. Anyway, thanks again for listening to this episode of Folklore, Food and Fairy Tales.